We're talking about learning machines, the quest for the ultimate learning machine, the master algorithm. Pedro Domingos, our special guest, the professor's with us, and we'll be back with more your questions on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Pedro Domingos with us, the professor. We're going to get to your calls as well. I find this to be fascinating, Pedro, this entire subject of artificial intelligence, machines that learn. I mean, it's truly amazing.
Yeah.
When social networking really popped, and popped in a big way, with MySpace and then Facebook and Snapchat and everything else that's out there, that too increased things for people, didn't it?
Yeah. I mean, in fact, I remember I was working on these things machine learning for word of mouth, right? How you propagate things in a social network. And at the time, there were no Facebook and there was no MySpace. And then all of a sudden, they came out of nowhere. And then, Facebook reaches over a billion people every day. I was actually just, giving a talk there, on Tuesday. And it's just amazing, what's happening now. That, you have someone at Facebook who, writes a piece of code in the morning, and in the afternoon it's being used by literally a billion people.
Yeah, it really is. You talk about how President Barack Obama used machines that learned to beat Mitt Romney in the 2012 presidential election. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, this is actually one of those things that I think everybody should be aware of and isn't, is the role that machine learning is playing in politics. And in particular, at the end of the day, machine learning is a big part of why Obama beat Romney. The things that usually decide elections, like the economy and, which candidate is more likable, they were a bit of a wash in the case of Romney and Obama. So it came down to the swing voters in the swing states. And now what Romney did was what, they usually do in politics, which is they did some polls, and then they targeted like these, broad demographic segments, suburban moms in Ohio.
That's right.
Obama, on the other hand, what he did was, he hired a machine learning researcher to be the chief scientist of his campaign, and then, Raed Ghani, and he put together this the biggest, team of data scientists that you ever saw in politics. And then what they did was the following. They predicted for every swing voter how likely they were to vote for Obama, to be swayed by a conversation about some topic if they were planning to not vote for Obama, how likely they were to show up at the polls. And they did this every night. And then the following day, the volunteers went out and knocked on the doors of the people that had been selected with pre-selected, topics to talk about. And as a result, Obama, he did an almost clean sweep of the swing states. And he won the election by a much bigger margin than people were predicting. And, this is a harbinger of things to come. Of course, the Republicans aren't standing still. They realize that you have to do this kind of thing to win elections these days. And, so there's this race between the Republicans and the Democrats to see who can best use data mining to sway voters.
Who was asleep at the wheel for Mitt Romney? Somebody.
Yes,
somebody should have realized
exactly. That's a very good question. The irony of this is that in the days of Karl Rove, the Republicans were ahead.
Yeah.
Karl Rove was actually a former direct marketer and data miner, and he knew a lot about how to use these techniques. And back then people said, the Republicans have an advantage because, they're in touch with business, and business knows how to do data mining. But unfortunately what happens is that these things dissolve, when the campaigns are over. And so the Republicans actually lost the edge that they have. At the same time, Obama, right, even in his first campaign, had a lot of very savvy people working for him. The Republicans just went back to doing sort of like the classic, traditional thing, which is very surprising, right, because Mitt Romney is a businessman and he worked in finance and whatnot. And I still don't understand why. They didn't do the kind of thing that Obama did, because it wasn't new by that point, right? I think somebody really did mess up big time.
What's new on the horizon? What will be the next evolution for people to use in politics or in business or in any other form that really will catapult people? What's next?
Yeah, I think, you know, one big thing that is going to affect business and politics and a lot of other things is this notion that today what you have are these learning algorithms that, you know, they recommend things for you, they make predictions for you. Like, for example, Amazon, you know, recommends books, and Netflix recommends movies, and you know, and Facebook selects which updates to show you and whatnot. But each of these things is based on a model of you, right? It's trying to understand you and predict what you want. But each of these things is based on only a very small data, you know, piece of data about you, right? You know, Amazon looks at what you've bought. You know, Google looks at the searches that you've done. What's really coming down the line, and I mean, all these companies are working on this, you know, big time, right? They know there's a race and they want to win, is a model of you that is learned not just from one little sliver of data, but from everything, from all the data that you produce. You know, and, you know, one place where this is happening is smartphones, right? Your smartphone captures an enormous amount of data about you. Both, you know, from its sensors like GPS and from the data that, you know, that you send, emails, voice, etc. And they're trying to build, and they will build, better and better and more complete models of you until they have like a 360-degree model of you that knows you very, very well. And then it makes recommendations. And in fact, you know, to some extent, it makes decisions on your behalf based on what it understands of you. And I think it's very important for people to realize that this is going on so that they can take control of this. I think in a way it's very good to have a model of you that, again, makes choices for you and reduces the information overload and whatnot. At the same time, that model should be under your control, right? Imagine having a very good, in a sense, these models are going to know you better than your best friend because they actually That's are right. with you every second of the day and your best friend isn't. Now imagine someone knowing you that well who has different, you know, goals than you do, right? And again, these companies all have their own goals. So, you know, I think people need to kind of, you know, get out in front and take control of this.
Will these machines, Pedro, have emotion?
They won't unless we program them to have emotions, right? But, you know, we are going to need to control these machines even if they're very intelligent. What we're going to do, and in fact, we already do that today, is that these algorithms, in essence, they have the analog of emotions. They have these, you know, like, you know, you have fear that, you know, causes it to run away from certain things. You have anger, you have desires, right? We actually put the analog of these things into machines, right? So they're not emotions, but they do the same job. They cause the machine, for example, you know, this is an analogy, but it's like, you have a program that really, really wants to solve cancer, right? It's doing everything it can to figure out cancer. It's like completely obsessed with it, right? This is one aspect of things. The other aspect is, as we get into these things like home robots and robots that interact with you, and you know these things like virtual assistants, you know, like Siri, right? It's this personality that talks to you. There will be a great advantage to giving them, you know, emotions. They're going to be virtual, synthesized emotions, but, you know, these things, they're going to have personalities. You're going to interact with them as you would with a human being. And I think there's going to be a race to make them as, you know, because emotional things can be more seductive, more addictive than things that are very flat. So this idea of like this metal robot that is very impersonal is going to disappear very quickly. And what we're going to see is a race to try to make these, all these machines and these robots and these virtual assistants look and act as much like human beings with these emotions as they can make it.
Professor, will the machines show anger?
They will, if that serves their purpose, you know.
Wow.
And their purpose really is the purpose of whoever is programming the machine. You know, just to give you an example that already exists, right? There are these little toys called the Tamagotchi that are very popular in Japan that they basically just have a few buttons, but, you know, you have to quote-unquote feed them, and if they don't feed them, for example, they might get angry, right? They just make an angry expression. And right? The amazing thing is that these toys for some people are extremely addictive. They really want to feed the Tamagotchi so that it doesn't get angry or sad or whatever.
They'll have these robotic dogs that get mad at you and probably soil your carpet, let's say.
I wouldn't be surprised. Exactly. Yeah.
Let's go to the phones. Let's pick it up by going to Joseph in Montana, west of the Rockies. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I just want to comment on an opinion on the computer issue.
Sure.
I'm not into computers, but I see a dumbing down of at least America because, for example, the way I'm trying not to ramble here, but like, for instance, like the Golden Gate Bridge, those in that era, the inventors, the creators of the Golden Gate Bridge, they say was ahead of its time. But in my opinion, it was a part of its time. And nowadays, we rely on all this technology for our thinking, but yet there's no original thought. And I just, the whole dumbing down thing is kind of what my question was. What's your opinion?
Yeah, well, I think there's two aspects to dumbing down, right? There's one aspect that is actually not necessarily so bad, which is we farm things out to computers, as a result of which we don't need to do them as much anymore, right? So, writing, right, improves your memory, because you can write things down, and Google improves your memory because, things are on the web, right? Having said that, it's very dangerous, right, when people forget to do certain things that they might actually need to do at the end of the day. Right, so we are today, I think, in this funny phase of automation where things are kind of partly done by machines, partly done by people, and sometimes there's these gaps where airplanes are flown by autopilots, which is good because in some ways they're very safe and reliable, but every now and then it needs to switch over to the human pilot, and now the human pilot in some ways is out of practice and makes mistakes because they're a little bit rusty. So I think, some dumbing down is something that we have to worry about. I think, in some ways, creativity and originality, they are the hardest thing for computers to do. We are starting to do that with computers, but it is still something that we very much need human beings for, right? And then the question is like, well, are we developing people's creativity when, with the education system, do people have what they need to be creative? And I think in some ways they do, but in other ways, ironically, the information overload actually makes them dumber, right? They are so overwhelmed with information that they don't actually have the ability to step back and think creatively.
We've got a breaking story for us, by the way, in France this morning. There are at least 42 people killed, mostly elderly people, in a bus truck accident in France. Ugh, what another horrible story. Seems like this news, the news of horror stories, Pedro, doesn't ever seem to stop, does it?
No, it doesn't, right? And again, we were just talking about information overload, right? These days we have the ability to find out, like we just did, right, instantly, about all the tragedies that happen all over the world. So
Yeah.
we are ever more aware of all the things that go wrong, large and small, everywhere around the world.
I mean, minutes ago in France, 42 people just died going through this horror. I've tried to imagine a bus and a truck colliding with each other. These people, were probably singing and, having fun on a bus, older folks, and they're dead. 42 of them are dead. And we find out about it within minutes, and I'm across the globe. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling.
Let's go back to the phones. Joe in the Bronx in New York. Hey,
How you doing,
Joseph.
George?
Good.
I'd like to ask Pedro, how far away are we? You mentioned Siri just a little while ago. How far away are we to perfecting, maybe for desktops, like an Apple desktop, two-way communication by voice? I mean, where I can tell a computer where to go, or I can, similar to Siri. But according to Apple, they haven't yet perfected it yet to release something like that.
I mean, this is a good question, right? I think to some extent they already have it. The problem is that the kind of, voice interaction that you can have on a desktop today, I mean, the technology is the same as Siri, but the problem is actually the same, is that, like anybody who has used Siri knows, right? It does certain things very well, and then in other things it's unbelievably dumb. And it's hard for you to know a priori which is going to be which. And you know, companies like Apple are working very hard on making these systems smarter. And you know, for example, there's something that exists on the desktop today, which is this virtual customer service agent. You know, they even have an avatar that's generated by computer graphics and whatnot that does the job of customer service agents for you know, Fortune 500 companies and whatnot. You're like, my printer is broken, how do I fix it? And you can talk with this system. And sometimes things go very well, but sometimes the system really is not very smart and you still have to fail over to human beings. And I think what we're going to see in the next several years is, well, the computers will get better and better and they will do more and more things. But, you know, being able to be as flexible and as smart as a human is still some ways away.
Professor, tell me a little bit about your thoughts about the app world for computers. I mean, they seem to have revolutionized the smartphones, apps.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we were talking about mind-boggling things. There's perhaps nothing more mind-boggling than a smartphone,
yeah.
Right? And that one little thing that you can hold in your hand is more computing power than the whole world had 50 years ago.
That's right.
It's, you know, a bazillion different algorithms that are continuously learning about you. And there's all these apps, right, each of which knows how to do something for you, right? Now, when I talk to the people at these companies, you know, like, you know, Google, you know, Apple, you know, Microsoft and whatnot, one of the things that they're very worried about is that there are now so many apps and you know, you have to use so many apps to kind of go from one to the other to finally get what you want, like, you know, like figuring out where you're going to eat, you know, dinner and drive over there and whatnot, that this is a little, you know, too, you know, irritating for people. So part of why they want to have, you know, these things like, you know, Siri and the virtual assistant that just talks to you is to actually have something in, you know, they don't want you to be interacting with 1,000 apps anymore. They just want you to be interacting with one very nice, you know, personal assistant.
Right.
Then uses all the apps in the background. And, you know, this is, I think, where things are going.
I mean, when you think of the technology, Pedro, where two people could be taking pictures of each other and then in an instant, by the push of a button, send it to somebody 2,000 miles away or around the globe, and it's there, and the picture shows up on that other person's smartphone instantly, it's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, I mean, this would have been, you know, science fiction, right, you know, 10 or 20 years ago. In fact, the whole idea, you know, of having a video phone call, right, this used to be the butt of jokes, right? It was one of those predictions of something that would happen in the future,
yeah.
that actually hadn't happened. Well,
Dick Tracy.
You can do it with your smartphone. And another example of that is the Skype, you know, automatic translation, right? Where I can be here in the United States speaking in English to someone in China who is hearing me at the same time in Chinese with my voice. And they're speaking Chinese and they're talking, and I'm hearing them in English with their voice and their mannerisms.
And that's like with an app converter, isn't it? Or something like that?
This is Skype, right? It's, you know, Skype is not owned by Microsoft.
Right.
But they basically have a type of learning, you know, which is a neural network. We were talking about learning by imitating the brain. That's what it is.
That's amazing technology. Stay with us, Pedro. We're coming back. Final segment, final calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Pedro Domingos with us. Pedro, Isaac Asimov wrote a book called iRobot, where he talks about three laws of robotics, and they are: a robot may not injure a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. A robot must obey the orders given to it by human beings, except where such orders can conflict with the first law. And three, a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second laws. How accurate do you think those three points are?
They're great, right? So, you know, there's a lot of discussion about, you know, the ethics of robots, right? So if we let robots become soldiers, for example, what laws of ethics should they follow? And many of these discussions start from Asimov's laws, right, which are justifiably famous. However, what we're seeing is actually something that Asimov anticipated, is that just having those laws is not enough, right? All the stories, or most of the stories in iRobot, each one of them was about some failure of these laws, right? Some contradiction came up,
that's
something
right.
that the robot didn't know how to resolve just based on the laws, right? The world is a lot more complicated than just those three laws. And that's exactly the problem that we're actually facing today, is that it's not just enough to program laws like that into robots. They have to figure out how to act ethically in very concrete situations. I think part of how we can do that is by having them learn by observing what humans do. You know, the problem is that, you know, humans, the robots will be confused, I think, because we have these moral principles, but also often we don't obey them. So in some ways, you know, having to program, you know, these laws and this, you know, ethical behavior into robots is going to force us to figure out what it is that we really believe and how we really are.
If Isimov were alive today with today's technology, do you think he would change these three laws?
No, I think, you know, if you're going to have only three laws of robotics, those are probably pretty good, right? They are, you know, the three most important things that a robot should follow. You know, I think if Asimov was alive today, he would be very surprised by some aspects of technology, but others, you know, notably including things like robotics, he would feel right at home.
All right, let's go back to the calls now. John in Sebring, Florida. Hey, John, good to have you back with us. Go ahead.
George, thank you so much. Wonderful to be on. I'm going to ask the professor a question, but first a little bit about something you said, George, about barcodes on grocery items and no in the old way.
Mm-hmm.
In 1963, I asked my store manager, where I was a cashier at the time, what are these black lines on these cans? He said that would be the price someday, 1963.
I love it.
Now, the date of the first computer that I learned from some source was 1880s. They used electric tabulation to do the U.S. Census. And what's a professor know about such? And Dr. Pedro Dominguez, it's good to learn about you. I'll be looking for your book tomorrow. Tell us, if you will, all you feel like telling us about your wonderful formal education. Where do you go and so forth? I'll get off and let somebody else call in.
Okay, John, thanks. And where'd you grow up, Pedro, and go to school?
I grew up in Portugal, right? So I'm originally from Europe. And then I came to the United States for my PhD, which I got in California. And then, you know, and then I became a professor, you know, here in Seattle at the University of Washington.
And you sound like you love doing what you're doing.
I certainly do. You know, I think, you know, machine learning is just amazingly fascinating thing, and artificial intelligence and computer science in general.
How smart can humans get to continue to do what they're doing with the computers right now?
Yeah, I think this is actually the right question to ask, right? I think at the end of the day, all artificial intelligence is about augmenting our intelligence.
That's right.
It's about making us smarter, right? And in some ways, the more intelligent we can make the computers, the smarter we'll become. I think part of it will be we will no longer feel like we're using some external thing like a computer that you type into. You will just remember things. You will just know how to do certain things that, you know, that come because of the interface that you have with a computer, right? There's a lot of, you know, work these days on brain-computer interfaces where you control things just by thinking about them, and I think we're going to see more and more of that.
We go next to Rob in Vancouver in Canada. Hey, Rob, go ahead, sir.
Thanks for letting me be on. I'm glad that you guys mentioned Isaac Asimov before, and talking about the three rules, going into the Foundation series, Isaac Asimov has artificial intelligence on its own develop a fourth rule where the robots, if you want to say, have to protect man from himself. If I can postulate ask the question about what he's postulated, where artificial intelligence becomes so advanced and indistinguishable between, you know, AI and humans, that part of society splits, where part of it abolishes artificial intelligence and, you know, just makes it like a, you know, completely illegal or just because it's too advanced, and part of society embraces it. I don't know if he's ever given a consideration to that.
All right, Pedro, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of these things could happen, right? I think, you know, the Foundation Trilogy is actually quite fascinating in this respect, right? Because the basic idea is that you can predict how society will evolve well enough to actually, you know, intervene and cause it to go in one direction or another, right? And this is very much a question for us in machine learning is, if we have a mass algorithm, would it make that possible? You know, I would love to answer yes, but actually, unfortunately, the answer is probably no. human beings are very predictable in some ways, but in other ways, they're very unpredictable. And in some ways, societies, kind of contrary to what Asimov was thinking, whole societies in some ways are less predictable than individual human beings because they're much more complex. Now, you know, this idea of you know, the AI is protecting us from ourselves and some people being okay with that and others not being okay with that, I think this is very much going to happen, right? I think the key thing here is that it has to be me to decide that I want an AI to protect me from myself, right? I don't want anybody else telling me that an AI is going to protect me from myself. That's my decision to make. And different people will make it in different ways. But I think, you know, with AI, as with other technologies, the part of society that decides to, you know, to not have AI is going to, in the end, you know, be at a really serious disadvantage compared to the part that does. So, you know, it's going to be a very unequal match, let me put it that way.
Daniel in Richmond, California. There you go, Daniel. Thanks for calling.
Hey, this is Schrodinger's abandoned cat calling you guys up.
Go ahead.
I was telling you this is Schrodinger's abandoned cat.
Ah.
Schrodinger's cat.
Okay. Yeah, there you go.
I heard that cat got abandoned. Listen, this is your time trout jump friend, George.
Okay.
Excellent show, Pedro. I am an artificial intelligent learning machine. I have a microwave VLSI neural implant. And yesterday out here in the Silicon Valley, I presented the idea of deploying a publicly traded neural network to venturehack.com at this beautiful, really super high-class, high-tech exhibition conference. I presented the idea of to several of the heavy-hitting Silicon Valley companies, to Dr. Deng, as well as the idea of bringing the Brain Initiative, the President's Brain Initiative, together with the Human Brain Project in 26 countries to enhance everyone to their full to their full potential, both economically and socially. You can see the pitch for this presentation on my brand new website, timejumpteam.com. It's not optimized yet. I just put it up, but if you go to your search engine and type in www.timejumpteam.com, you can see the presentation. My question to you, Pedro, and George, and your listeners too, do you guys like the idea of deploying an international neural network with the highest standard of bioethics and taking that company public, so not just that company, but all these high-tech companies involved, can succeed, and every individual on the planet,
all right,
economically
let's,
and socially.
Let's defer to Pedro for that. Pedro, would something like that work? That sounds like it could be dangerous.
Well, it could be dangerous, right? And, you know, these projects that you talk about, right, there's one in the European Union, and there's one in the U.S., right? Their goal really is to understand the brain in very fine detail and to build, you know, a simulation of the brain from top to bottom. And this is both very exciting and very scary, right? Because let's suppose that they succeed, right? Then we will be able to have, you know, brains, you know, we will be able to enhance our own brains, but we'll also be able to create vast brains, you know, continent-spanning brains. And the question really is, at the end of the day, who's going to control that intelligence, right? If that kind of intelligence falls into the wrong hands, you know, we're in deep trouble.
And that could fall into the wrong hands.
It definitely could, yeah.
Who's going to screw
this?
You know,
it's a little bit like the Manhattan Project, right?
Yeah.
It's, you know, we'd better, you know, develop an atomic bomb before the Nazis do. And, you know, it's the same thing with this, right? This is a race that we had better win, because if we lose it, we will really regret it.
There's been a concern that China, for example, will make zillions of drones and then just fly them here. How could we get them all and knock them all down?
I mean, you know, the army of the future, you know, this, you know, the war of the future could be, if there's a World War III, it could be over very quickly, right? Because I might have 10,000 tanks, but if China has, you know, 10 million drones, they could destroy my tanks very quickly, right? So part of that is to make sure that, you know, we have the, you know, better, smarter, and also, you know, more drones than, you know, than whoever the enemy is does, right? And some of that just comes down to, you know, manufacturing capability. But the other part of that is cyber war, right?
Yeah.
You know, if China has, you know, a billion drones, but I'm able to hack into them and control them, then now I've won the war, right? So this, I think, is going to be a very interesting contest that is going to be fought on many different levels.
Do they have little drones that are as small as flies?
Yes, they do. I mean, several countries are working on this. You know, DARPA, the Pentagon's research arm, this is one of the big things that they're working on, is in essence having drones that are as small as dragonflies and whatnot. And in fact, they've been funding a lot of, you know, zoologists, right? People who study biology for a living, because they want to understand how these insects fly and turn around and catch their prey, right? They want drones that are able to do the same. They need power sources that are lightweight enough. All of this is things that, you know, several different countries are working on, including, of course, the U.S.
Won't they make little drone assassins?
They might, right? In fact, this is one of the worries, right? The thing about making a little drone assassin is that actually the drone has to be big enough to carry something that can actually kill you.
A little right? piece of ricin.
That actually limits how small the drone can be. Nevertheless, you know, this is a concern, right? I mean, you've seen these things in the news, those things, you know, like drones dropping off packages for prisoners in jails. And you know, I don't think it's going to be very long before we see a hit being carried out by a drone, right? I mean, you know, the U.S. does that, you know, in Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, killing terrorists. One of these days, some crime boss is going to use a drone to kill somebody that they want to kill. So we also have to think about protecting ourselves from these things.
Michael's in Virginia Beach in Virginia. Go ahead, Michael.
Yes, Pedro, you've talked about computer-assisted politics. I'm concerned about computer-assisted religion being infused in politics. Today is October 23rd. Today is the day that Paul Ryan has set as the deadline for the Freedom Caucus to choose him. And now we hear they're willing to do it and eliminate the vacate the speaker rule, the move to vacate the speaker. That would make him an ultimate dictator, having the power of a Hitler. These men who said they were going to make us free have chosen the man who's allied with Luis Gutierrez, identified by Mark Levin as the greatest communist in Congress. These two men are perfectly allied. Gutierrez is from Puerto Rico. I would like for you, Pedro, and for George Norrie to talk to Mark Levin about how this computer-assisted crisis has been created by the Romans in Washington.
Well, we've got 20 seconds left, Pedro. I don't expect you to answer that, but that does tell you that sometimes this intelligence for computers could get out of hand, doesn't it?
Like Thomas Jefferson said, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. We need it more than ever.
So true, my friend. So true indeed. Thank you for being on Coast to Coast. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Timothy Banal, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, and George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.